Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with my guests, Hanna Schellest and Marina Rabinovich, about the book that edited and that they recently published, Decentralization, Regional Diversity, and Conflict, The Case of Ukraine, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Hanna Schellest is the Security Studies Program Director, Editor-in-Chief of UA Ukraine Analytica, and Head of the Board of the NGO Promotion of Intercultural Cooperation. Prior to this, she had served for more than 10 years as a senior researcher at the National Institute for Strategic Studies under the President of Ukraine, Odessa Branch. In 2014, Dr. Schellest served as a Visiting Research Fellow at the NATO Defense College in Rome. Previously, she had experience in PR and lobbying for government and business, as well as teaching at Odessa National University. She has more than 50 academic and more than 100 articles in media published worldwide. And Marina Rabinovich is assistant professor at the Department of Public Policy and Governance at the Kiev School of Economics. Dr. Rabinovich's research interests include international and EU development policy with a focus on political development and fundamental values, rule of law, democracy, good governance, international and EU trade policy, EU external relations and their legal regulation, as well as the actual issues pertaining to Ukrainian politics and law, such as the reform of decentralization and conflict settlement. She publishes her works in international peer-reviewed journals such as East European Politics, Brill Open Law, Journal of Contemporary European Research. Hello, Hanna and Marina.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me today, and congratulations on the publication of your collection of essays. The volume that you edited, Decentralization, Regional Diversity and Conflict, The Case of Ukraine, covers a lot of issues which are pertinent to the situation that shape internal and external policies in Ukraine today. I would like to start with regional diversity, which to a large extent is one of the aspects that is still rather hard to manage for a number of legal, constitutional regulations and decisions. One of the central points of the volume revolves around the historical premises of regional diversity in Ukraine. Would you clarify this point? Why does regional diversity play a crucial role in today's political environment of Ukraine? And what are the main challenges?
I would probably start, and that is a really good question. It's probably one of the central in this book, and you can find it not only in the chapters about regional diversity, but as a red line in many others. And the idea is that very often the existing regional diversity, which is the benefit of Ukraine, it's something that is created by the years of history, of the difficult history of Ukraine, and what is accepted inside of the country as an advantage of the country, is very often manipulated politically, manipulated by the external forces, including the covert operations or information operations against Ukraine. It became one of the red lines since 2004 in the political campaigns in the struggle for power, when political technologists started to use it as a disadvantage, not as an advantage of Ukraine. And what is more important that within the last years, probably since 2014, but the first examples were even earlier, and our book also demonstrated this issue became securitized. So from the classical constructivist point of view, that is probably one of the best examples, how you can take the issue that exists, that is not a problem, that is just an issue, a fact, and you're starting to securitize it in each of the decisions, of the statements of international institutions, of your foreign partners, of your enemies, and of the internal political discourse. So that is why for us this regional diversity was extremely important, and for our authors to demonstrate that the existence of regional diversity should be studied first, not just used as the manipulation argument, that if you look to the real facts, the regional diversity is not a problem, but definitely very often in the contemporary discourse around the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, that is the issue that is probably the easiest to be used to demonstrate that Ukraine has problems. So through the articles, we really wanted the authors to demonstrate the real picture, to give as much as possible information, because without information, with certain information vacuum, we are coming to the problem that we give others the voice about the real situation with the regional diversity of Ukraine.
Thank you, Hannah. Marina?
Awesome. I agree with Anna to a great extent about the role regional diversity plays in contemporary political environment and security environment in Ukraine. But what I wanted to add to what Anna said is the importance of accommodating and managing regional diversity. Because before the conflict, as Oksana Mushlovska illustrated in her chapter, there have barely been some well-conceptualized policies in Ukraine that would look into the diversity and that would employ particular tools to manage it. Therefore, our idea and our focus was to show that the reform of decentralization, so we also regard it as a reform whose aim is to accommodate regional diversity while recognizing that diversity is in place and we shall not ignore it. And at the same time, as Anna said, not allowing others to accommodate it the way others would love to do that.
Mm-hmm. I have a follow-up question on this issue of diversity. So maybe we could specify what kind of diversity is meant here. So maybe it's regional diversity, ethnic diversity, demographic diversity. So maybe a little some more clarification here. And as Anna mentioned, diversity can be used as an advantage, as a disadvantage. And could we just give a couple of examples how diversity can be used as a disadvantage, actually, as well as advantage as well?
Mm-hmm. I would probably start from this last question and we'll leave more options for Marina for the beginning of it. When we speak about the disadvantage, we clearly saw it in 2014-15, especially in such regions as the Zakarpattia or Bessarabia, the south of Odessa region. When, for example, Bessarabia is very multi-ethnic. You have the Albanian, Bulgarian, Moldovan, Ukrainian villages, Gagauzian. These people speak their own languages. For 300 years, we've never seen conflicts there. Mm-hmm. So these people can speak simultaneously at all these languages, and they always thought about this diversity as the advantage, as the multicultural, as a tolerance, as the best examples of how different ethnic groups can live at the same land. But in 2014, 2015, there were plenty of examples when through the gossips, through the statements of some politicians, we started to see the first examples of the clashes. Luckily, not physical clashes, but these issues started to be in between certain ethnic groups, that never had problems before, and also between these multi-ethnic districts and Kyiv as a central government. Because they started, politicians started to say then that they have problems in economic sphere, for example, in social sphere. That is because they are from the different ethnic groups. Just because they wanted to get these groups for their political advantages to support certain political parties. And the same, if you study the reports of the security services of Ukraine, there were numerous attempts to fire certain inter-ethnic relations. In Zakarpattia, the best example, when the Polish nationalist paid by the Russian security services burned the Hungarian cultural center. It sounded like a crazy situation from some bad movie, but that was a real case because initially it was accepted as the anti-Hungarian sentiments of Ukrainians, and definitely we had a diplomatic scandal between Hungary and Ukraine. So you can imagine how the existence of the certain ethnic groups can, especially when they live compactly at the certain territories, can be used to destabilize the situation. Political and inter-ethnic situation. And I can name plenty of examples like this. The same case is definitely sometimes with the Crimean Tatars, who were the IDPs moving to the Kherson region, or like many situations. That's why we understand perfectly how it can be used as a disadvantage. At the same time, definitely, when you have a careful approach, tailored-made approach, we see how we can use these multi-ethnic situations, for example, as an advantage, describing that, come on, but for 300 years we've lived together for good, and we always had it without any problems. So from the appreciate inquiry approach, mm-hmm. here looking like why we managed to live like this, what brought these problems, and how we can solve, can it be examples for others? The same is with the democratic plurality and this regional diversity, because we understand that in different regions, sometimes different parties are like more popular. All disadvantages we know. It brought us to Maidan first and Euromaidan second, to many other difficult political campaigns. But at the same time, when we speak, for example, with our counterparts, so from other post-Soviet space, we always can say, come on, but that is democracy. Mm-hmm. When you have these different political parties, okay, maybe in the different regions, that what makes this plurality of opinions, and that is what is the real democracy. Maybe we are still democracy in progress, in transformation, but that is. So it is no black and white. Mm-hmm. You always can find how to use this situation, how to manipulate with it, or how to find the positive examples and to move forward with the reforms and transformation of the society.
Mm-hmm. So trying to develop a follow-up to this, just one more example of a disadvantage that came to my mind linked to the reform of decentralization has been the recent reform of rayons, when in Ukraine before there were like more than 400 rayons, but now in terms of the decentralization reform, in order to increase their capacity, their quantity was diminished to 136. And the issue that immediately came to the surface was that Ukrainian government tries to create a separate Hungarian rayon or Hungarian area in order to then give this area to Budapest, if speaking in simplest terms. So we can see that the diversity can be instrumentalized whenever there is any issue, and then the government always has to give some rebuttal. Actually, responding to these allegations, the government was saying that actually now, since this area or rayon is quite big, there are many more Ukrainians living there than it was before, when rayon was small and they were just people of Hungarian origin. Nevertheless, fake news appear very quickly, and they spread easily, and sometimes they are very easy to believe. That's why regional diversity can become a disadvantage when the world is more governed by fake news, by post-truth, and all these contemporary peculiarities of international relations. Regarding the types of diversity that addressed, our ambition was to touch upon different types of diversity, and apart from regional diversity per se that Oksana Myslovska dealt with, we also included linguistic diversity and tried to find out how the Constitutional Court of Ukraine addressed linguistic diversity in its decisions. And also we had a separate contribution about Crimean Tatars, their identity, and the way they perceived the conflict by Alina Zubkovic from Stockholm, who currently works with Swedish Institute. It could be also nice to have a piece on religious diversity, but unfortunately the volume of the book didn't allow for this. But actually, any kind of diversity can be instrumentalized, securitized, can become a topic for fake news. Therefore, basically all possible types of diversity need to be taken into account when new governmental policies are being developed.
Well, do you believe that this kind of instrumentalization of diversity was used in the past, not at the current moment, but how the way we deal with the diversity changed over time? But I'm particularly interested in this idea of instrumentalization of diversity, because it's quite a fascinating idea how diversity can be used as in some positive aspects as well as in some negative aspects. So the line is really very gray there.
You know, probably one of the examples in the book that we have is quite an interesting analysis about the language diversity and the use of it in the Constitutional Court of Ukraine. So how the different political parties have been using their request to the Constitutional Court. And what is interesting that it has been used not by one political party, so it has been used from both political spectrums, mm-hmm. from both language groups, that is more for the just Ukrainian language use, or those who are for two Russian and Ukrainian languages to be used in the daily life. So we have a very interesting article by Andriy Nikolak, who described exactly with the different examples through the, I don't know, probably 10 years. He took the most, or even earlier, if I'm not mistaken, since 2004, he took the cases when the members of parliament been asking the Constitutional Court for clarification. Mm-hmm. And very interesting how purely legal issues are transformed because... it is like a circle, you know, the closed circle. Political parties being political, asking Constitutional Court for the legal issues. But at the same time, Constitutional Court doesn't want to give just the legal decision mm-hmm. because they are afraid to be caught in this political confrontation. And they are not giving the clear answer. So it is not the answer that can satisfy one side. And they are returning back the ball to the side of political parties because sometimes they were telling that it's not in their competition. Sometimes they were giving the decisions that can be read as you want, but not bringing clarity. Mm-hmm. So his article is probably one of the best examples how you can instrumentalize it even in such a political legal issues, not only in the pure political competition between the different sides in Ukraine. Mm-hmm.
I would say... In terms of history, in terms of Ukrainian history, there have been many examples when diversity was to some extent instrumentalized by different parties, by the proponents of different ideas, such as the idea of economic special zones in Ukraine. For instance, with Odessa, as far as I know, there were the ideas of renewing Porto Franco. And then Odessa history was also instrumentalized in its terms, saying that Odessa is a great city, it shall have some special status, and so on and so forth. And when somebody says special status, one can already make different deviations in this regard. However, before all these large culture of fake news and propaganda started to develop, this instrumentalization wasn't that, I would say, that great. It wasn't of such a scale as it is now. However, now with Facebook algorithms, it's possible to create totally different virtual worlds for different categories of people, for people in different countries. And therefore, and now this instrumentalization becomes ever stronger and ever more easy to do.
I would like to talk more about the current conflict between Ukraine and Russia, and you already mentioned to some extent how diversity was misused, right, during this conflict. Regional diversity weighs in to the problem, but on a populist level, this diversity is often simplified to the level of what ethnicity or nationality we speak about, and in this case, it's primarily about the Ukrainian and Russians. Your volume offers to look at the self-proclaimed so-called republics, Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic, which are supported by the Russian Federation. What does regional diversity help understand what the about these regions? What diversity and what traits of diversity should be emphasized here, if any, of course? And I think it pertains to the remark which was made by Hanna earlier, that diversity can be used to solve conflicts. So how can we use diversity in this case to solve this kind of conflict?
No, we're speaking more on behalf of our authors who express their opinions here, but definitely mine and Marina's opinions are in the introduction to the book, why this topic is important. And it seems to me that what book demonstrated, especially about Russian-Ukrainian conflict and so-called Dieperian LPR, is that over there, it is the clear constructed conflict when their weaknesses and some difficulties of the like socioeconomic or political, but not ethnic or diversity issues have been used by the adversary country. And but at the same time, what is really important that our authors demonstrate that even if you don't have a problem, through the years, you can develop it to the to the real problem. That's how through the years, we probably not create, but develop the local identity. When the local identity is becoming more important for the people than the original identity. And the research is definitely, the articles demonstrate that we even don't speak about the whole region. Yep. Let's be honest and let's explain to our listeners that when we say Donbass in the news, it's not even the whole Donbass. We're speaking about one third of Donetsk and Lugansk regions. And we speak about just 5% of the territory of Ukraine. So we are not speaking about certain unity, which is clear, like Catalonia in Spain, for example, yeah, or Bavaria in Germany. We are speaking just about individual towns that have been occupied and where, after the 6 years, through propaganda, through military presence, through the conflict, through the economic issues, the local identity can has been cultivated. That's probably the best word to describe it. We always had a certain Eastern Ukrainian identity that's been created mostly after 1950s, when this region received a lot of Russians from the Soviet Union to reconstruct the mining industries and metallurgical industries. So definitely there were certain regional particularities, let's say. But it is not the same particularities that make regions to separate or to make the new countries. So here it is probably the perfect example of the misuse of the diversity rather than to satisfy the certain political ambitions, or even better to say, to use by Russia to control Ukraine. Because here, probably the best example how we understand different in terms of terminology about diversity. We have a wonderful article by Nadia Koval, who is showing how the word that federalization is understood differently in Germany, Russia, and Ukraine. That for Germans, federalization is good. It's nothing bad. Yep, it's how the good functional state is working. So when they use it about Ukraine, proposing it as a solution for the Donbas conflict, they mean only good things. But at the same time, we have a Russia who is also a federal state, but where no real power in the regions, and who doesn't want to bring the equal powers to all regions of Ukraine. But they propose just for this 5% of the territory of Ukraine, with the only idea to have a control over domestic and foreign policy of Ukraine. So Nadia, in her article, demonstrates how through this wording, through the terminology, we have a completely different narratives and policies, and how sometimes proposing the good ideas from diversity, as we started talking from diversity, the results are negative. So do no harm is probably the best concept to be examined for Ukraine, when some of the mediators or external experts would like to propose the best solution from their experience, but not look into the real roots of the conflict or the real arguments of another side. They're bringing harm, but not the good decision. They're cultivating these separatist ideas just in these individual towns, which are currently completely controlled by the Russian Federation. So that's why it seems to me that in our book, a lot of authors try to demonstrate that it is not a single and simple decision, that risk assessment should be done probably for most of the decision, that even decentralization as a way to appraise the diversity of Ukraine, and we understand we are speaking about almost 50 million people, we're speaking about a huge country, where decentralization can be seen as a positive because you can't control the whole country from the center. But at the same time, they demonstrate how, in case you don't estimate the risks, mitigate the risks that this reform is bringing, that the ideas of special status for Donbas is bringing, we can bring even more problems, more difficulties, and just to give instruments to those who would like to destabilize Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say before Marina gives her kind of response to this question, I just wanted to say that it was such a wonderful example with that notion of federalization as understood in Germany, Russia, or Ukraine, for example. And you specified some terminology, right, that somehow shapes that kind of understanding. I believe we can also add some different history in terms of historical developments, cultural developments, and political history, and that history of a democracy that all three countries have, and they, of course, different, and that somehow also contributes to this different understanding of federalization, but wonderful, wonderful example of a federalization. Marina?
I'd like to make 2 points. With regard to the previous question, let's say the first point is about terminology. Like, terminology is the thing that matters a lot, both in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, in terms of its resolution, and in terms of writing about the conflict. I would say it took us 3 years from the very first proposal to do the book until it was published, and maybe more than 1.5 years has been the debate about terminology with the publishing house. Initially, our idea was to address the conflict as many authors suggested, and as it's usually said in Ukraine, our idea was to name it Ukrainian-Russian War, or at least the conflict in the Ukrainian conflict, or the Ukraine conflict, or something like this. However, what we heard from the publishing house was that there may be readers with a different opinion. So if you read between the lines, readers who would share Russia's position as regards the conflict as a civil war in Ukraine, and that's why we needed to find like the most neutral way to address the conflict. And that made us select the definition from the OSCE, saying that the conflict shall be named the conflict in and around Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So this term can be also seen as contested, because people ask, okay, and what does around Ukraine mean? Does it mean somewhere in Belarus it is around Ukraine, or maybe somewhere in Poland also around Ukraine? Nonetheless, the sole thing we could have done was to rely on the definition by international organization and say we are not judges, we are not international adjudicators, and we don't have the competences to define the nature of the conflict itself. Also, when we speak about people who are in Donbas, some people would say they are postantje. I don't even know the word and how they call it in English.
Rebellions.
Are rebellions. Others would say they are just people who live in the occupied territories. Others would say there are Russian allies, whatever. So anytime you select a term to define something in terms of Ukrainian-Russian conflict, you need to think carefully what term you select. Otherwise, there can be a scandal or just a huge misunderstanding. Even when we selected the term the conflict in and around Ukraine, we still heard very different opinions about that. So terminology matters, and that's why it's very important to define concepts, to study concepts, and to be able to clarify to a large number of people in Ukraine and beyond Ukraine what each concept actually means. And the second point is about the constructed nature of the conflict. As Anna was saying, I wanted to make a different example also from the book chapter, the chapter by Yaroslava Barbkiri from the University of Birmingham. She was trying to find out whether the decentralization reform was a good tool to address the conflict. And what she found was that the decentralization was also misused, not just federalization, but decentralization, because there have been so-called fake communities, or when parallel to new amalgamated communities, pro-Russian forces tried to establish their own amalgamated communities and kind of size power in some places, for instance, in Kherson Oblast, in Nikolaev Oblast, and locals were even believing that these people are real authorities of newly created communities. Similar initiatives, so would say, existed with regard to some new special economic zones and some other forms of accommodating regional diversity. Kind of parallel structures of power can be initiated wherever. And in case locals, especially there are some old people who don't listen to news very often or people who don't follow politics, can even believe that some parallel power structures are real power structures. And that's why it's still important for the government, even though this is decentralization, to control what happens in border regions especially, and to control whether no parallel structures emerge, either more or less openly or remain in a shadow.
Mm-hmm. Well, terminology matters indeed, and yes, that's very true. And I would just add to that it's important, and that's why I believe your volume is so significant and so important, because it gives this representation of the problem right from multiple angles. And what we have to deal today is the narratives that come from Russia on the one hand, right, how they talk about this conflict, and on the other hand we have Ukraine, but unfortunately Ukraine doesn't have that much representation in terms of, let's say, English Anglophone resources in the media space. And there is always this clash between the Ukrainian representation and the Russian representation in terms of media resources. And I think that your volume does contribute a lot to this kind of shaping of how we can look at this conflict and what aspects should be considered when we talk about the conflict, which is not only in the Donbas, but in Crimea as well. Also, could you comment a little bit on that terminology about Crimea, because there are some notes in your volume about how we approach the annexed Crimea.
Probably just a few words from my side, because the Crimea, we are not taking it from the political point of view in terms of the special status for Crimea or indigenous people. What is quite an important, but probably deserve a special book just about this. And we know that now the interest in Crimean topic is becoming more and more, so we hope that such books will appear in the future as well. And we see more and more work at the political level in terms of articles, media, talking about this. But at the same time, it is very important to look how the Crimean Tatars, who are a different ethnic religious group and quite a special group in the Ukrainian society, but that have been witnessing the aggression and occupation firsthand, what is their self-identification? How much they self-identify themselves as a part of Ukraine? So what is their place in this self-identification? What can be their, like, when we speak about Ukrainian, is it means just to be ethnic Ukrainian? And it seems to me that with the chapters about Crimean Tatars, we have quite a good demonstration in their commands, because what is good, article by Alina Zubkov, she is exactly answering like Crimean Tatars and the question of national and ethnic belonging in Ukraine. Because in Russian and Ukrainian language, it's always a mix. It is coming from the Soviet Union terminology, these ethnic and national belonging. So very often saying being Ukrainian, people are thinking only about being ethnic Ukrainian. And with the interviews that Alina demonstrates with quotations of different people, that mostly IDPs who are now living in different parts of the country, what for them means being Crimean Tatars, but at the same time being Ukrainian. With what is associated, is it more or less being feeling one or another? Mm-hmm. So that is definitely, we couldn't cover all questions of Crimean Tatars' identity, but we wanted to incorporate it because it demonstrated the diversity, which is wider than the Western audience is thinking. Because as you said about Anglophone readers, usually when they think about Ukraine and any kind of ethnic diversity or any kind of diversity, they're thinking about Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, or even worse, what I noticed in the several sociological research recently, Russian and Ukrainian ethnic groups. So it doesn't matter that a lot of the ethnic Russians are much bigger Ukrainian nationalists than other Ukrainian ethnics. So they don't understand this difference. They are taking it just from the clear distinction, Russian, Ukrainian. So here, adding the Crimean Tatar component to this diversity, we demonstrate that the picture is much wider, that it's not conflict between majority Ukrainian population and minorities like Russians who probably have some problems at the political or ethnic level. That we also have another big ethnic group that is much more national Ukrainian, if you can say this like this in English, but associate themselves much more with the Ukrainian state, Ukrainian citizenship, Ukrainian statehood, that even some of the ethnic Ukrainian are doing. So that's why it seems to me that these chapters about Crimean Tatars are really, like, I enjoyed reading them a lot, because they give you not just the gossips or something, but they give you quite a coherent and complex vision of what does mean to be Crimean Tatar, but at the same time Ukrainian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Hanna. Marina? Well, I have a question about decentralization that has been discussed for a long time, but its effectiveness leaves much to be desired. Why the process of decentralization has been so slow? What administrative decisions should be implemented as well? And does decentralization entail the change of how we think about state and power as well? Because part of the book is about these difficulties that you know, we've been having with this process. Marina?
The regime of decentralization is considered widely to be a success story among the reforms that were done after the Euromaidan. And I would challenge this idea that it was slow. I wouldn't say it was slow, because other reforms were taking much more time than decentralization. For instance, the reform of justice sector, I remember 10 years ago when I was studying at the law faculty in Odessa, I heard a case where there is a reform of the justice sector ongoing, and still the reform of the justice sector sector is ongoing and will be ongoing since like forever. The reform of decentralization has two clear, or more or less clear stages. The first stage was until 2019, and it from 2014, and it embraced this very process of community amalgamation, of granting them additional authorities, plus additional financial resources for them to be able to deal with these new authorities. And the second stage is from 2020 to 2021, and it basically embraces these changes to administrative territorial order of Ukraine, plus it also includes the changes to the constitution. And in my view, the only really challenging thing with decentralization are these changes to the constitution and decentralization's relation with the Minsk process and with the peace process in Donbass. Because initially, decentralization was introduced independently on the peace process as a way to strengthen Ukraine, as a way to strengthen communities and giving them this very feeling of being the masters of their places and govern some local affairs. However, then in the Minsk Agreement, centralization was also put forward as one of the political conditions of the Minsk process. When you look at the key legal acts that govern decentralization, you will not find the link to the Minsk process. It was also part of my research for the book, so I could talk quite a lot about these. So basically, this link is still missing, and therefore, introducing decentralization into the constitution while the Minsk process is still being extensively hampered, it's not really possible. On the other hand, when decentralization is just a nuance, it can be washed off by the next parliament, and it's not that a difficult thing, because when you have decentralization and financial resources provided for in the constitution, as is the case for Germany, for the federal lender, and for the finances lender, then you always entail the risk that either there would be the communities will be once again somehow reformed, or they will receive insufficient funds, and it's already the case with the new subventions. Therefore, some constitutional provisions are necessary, but very difficult to do. And I would say that it would be quite a surprise in case it will become possible, given the situation with the Minsk process and with the local elections. Regarding the statehood question, I agree that decentralization shall entail some new vision of the state and new vision of communities and people there. Because before, they were basically, the approach was largely top down. They were receiving some money from the government. They didn't have a lot of legal pathways to earn money. They didn't have enough capacity to do something, to do projects, to receive funding from third-party sources. So they were largely dysfunctional. Now, there are a lot of opportunities for them to receive funding and to improve life in communities very directly, to own medical institutions, to own educational institutions. However, capacity is still a large issue. And another large issue is this very feeling of being the master of your community and being able to manage it effectively. So like management, capacity, and all these projects really is really still a challenge for communities, and a lot will depend on specific people in the specific community and how they manage issues they have. Also, just another small remark about that, about the capacity issue. I have read the analysis about how the subventions are being used, and the vast majority of funds from the national fund for regional development are still being used for some operational projects, like to build the road or to do some renovation in the hospital, whatever, but there are virtually no projects that can offer you more income in the future. So the economic activity of communities remains very low, and there are not so many chances and not so many best practices maybe on how to do some enterprises at the community level, how to manage them, and so on and so forth. But that's why like turning communities into business subjects to some extent is really a challenge for decentralization alongside all these political, constitutional, and means cross-related issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Marina. Hanna, would you like to add anything to this?
No, it is good because for decentralization, we can talk for hours and hours. It is still processed, and it seems to me that the biggest risks and opportunities we will see after October 25, when Ukraine have a local elections, and it will be the first elections according to the new administrative structure of Ukraine, with the new rules and with the new powers for the local authorities. So it seems to me that the real situation we can evaluate, let's say, in the beginning of 2021, when the results of these elections will be visible and when the first decisions at the local level will be taken. Definitely, and you can see it in some of the articles that our authors touched, that not only that decentralization can be misused, what Marina described in her previous statements, but also that it is such a complex issue. It's not just redrafting the borders of certain regions or just giving a little bit more power to the local authorities, but we understand that it is just a first stage, and it can bring both decisions to some conflict or risks to some conflicts to start, as we will see the further changes in the law for education, at the financing at the local level, and especially in the multi-ethnic districts of Ukraine, we can see the further development and further implications. But at the same time, that's definitely a Ukrainian argument, as our book is about decentralization, diversity, and conflict. So definitely we look to the decentralization only from this point of view. And here we understand perfectly that when Russia is speaking about federalization or special status, Ukraine always has an argument, but for why you need it. You need it for the bigger powers for the local. That's what decentralization is bringing. That's what we are already doing. And you want greater powers only for a few towns on the east, and we want bigger powers to the whole country, to all local authorities. And here it is very important for us because we understand perfectly the risk. As soon as we give bigger powers, changes to the constitutions for Donbas, why Odessa or Dnipropetrovsk or Zhytomyr would not be able to say, why them, why not us? So definitely through such an individual approach, we can bring bigger risks and bigger conflict potential to the whole country. So we are describing how decentralization, in case implemented perfectly, can contribute both to the conflict mitigation in Ukraine, but also to the European integration. That is probably one of the aspects that we haven't discussed yet, but what is in the book, that few of our authors also looked through all these problems through the lens of European integration of Ukraine, how it can assist us, how it can facilitate the process, or maybe how it can bring certain difficulties. So for Ukraine, when the European integration is chosen as the strategic course of the country, it is very important also to look at these processes through the lens of the European Union norms and European Union integration process of Ukraine.
Could we draw parallels between the case of Ukraine and other international cases in terms of managing regional diversity and interstate conflicts as well?
We probably have the best example is Marina article that you can find in this book, where she looked at the special status as one of the aspects of this diversity. Because very often in Ukraine, we are saying that Ukrainian conflict is unique. Definitely it is, as any conflict in the world. But definitely we have certain parallels with the Moldovan Transnistrian Republic and with Abkhazia and South Ossetia conflict with Georgia, not only because Russia is involved in all three conflicts, but also because Russia used a lot of instruments and methods directly or indirectly, and we can see the parallels from negotiations to the peace propositions and to the propaganda narratives. What is interesting, we've been comparing, it is not in the book, in other researchers, we started comparing the propaganda narratives from 1992, 1995 in Transnistria and 2014 in Ukraine. They were the same. So that's why it is very important also to look to the special status, because in both Georgia and Moldova, the separatist regions received the special status. And in Marina's article, you can read how she's comparing how the special status been evolving, how it is in the documents, and looking what are the parallels, what may be lessons learned for Ukraine, both positive and negative. So in this case, it's not only diversity, but also the instrumentalization of this diversity as an example for Ukraine.
Marina, would you like to tell us a few words about your article?
Yeah, like the idea of my article, it comes from the fact, okay, as a way, I come from the legal background, and therefore I had this impression that the conflict in Ukraine was mostly studied from the international law standpoint, but nobody looked at the way Ukraine itself defines the conflict and defines the fact of states, and therefore I decided to look at Ukrainian domestic laws, plus the laws by Moldova and Georgia. And what I found was that Ukraine has kind of two approaches being combined. It has special status law, offering special status to Donbas, kind of in response to ceasefire and the fulfillment of other conditions by the Russian Federation. And on the other hand, it has the reintegration law that says that Russian Federation is an occupying force and so on and so forth. But special status looks like the approach by Moldova, and the reintegration looks like an approach from Georgia. So it basically took both approaches and incorporated them into domestic law. And even though now we don't see some real-life collisions that come from this fact, I would say that in case Minsk process proceeds, then it will be really difficult to maintain both tracks of regulating the status of territories in Donbas region. And another thing to say, that the next step I'm going to implement about this research is to look at the coherence of Ukraine's domestic legislation with Ukraine's approach to the strategic use of warfare at the international arena. Basically, to see how Ukraine speaks the conflict and how Ukraine speaks occupied territories when using the warfare and when speaking to the domestic audience. And what I also found was the domestic legislation, it doesn't just influence what takes place in Ukraine, but it also influences conflict transformation internationally, because it largely sets kind of red lines of that the government cannot go beyond, and at the same time provides some background for international negotiations, also showing to our partners how we approach the conflict and what can we be ready for in terms of the negotiations. Also talking about the examples, what we can compare the conflict with, I would like to mention maybe what should have been mentioned in the beginning, is that the book is published in this series. It's called Federalism and Internal Conflict. So the word internal should not be misused in this vein, because there are no perfectly internal conflicts nowadays in the world, because external powers always take place therein. And the series, it embraces very different conflicts, from the ones in Nigeria, that we barely know about, to the ones in Bosnia and Herzegovina and the experiences of dealing with it, the conflicts in other post-Yugoslavian countries, and that's why there is basically a big deal of conflicts that we that were attempted to settle via the so-called territorial self-governance mechanisms, such as federalization and decentralization. And even though the circumstances pertaining to each conflict can be very different, all these experiences of federalization, decentralization, and other territorial self-governance solutions deserve our attention as scholars, because some aspects can be close to each other in very different contexts. Even maybe Ukraine and Nigeria may have something in common, and we can use some best practices from all over the world to implement the peace process and to deal with decentralization further and to proceed with it.
Thank you, Marina. So as your volume shows, there are a lot of things to consider, but and there is so much to do still in spite of all the aspects that were considered for your volume and in spite of all the aspects that were considered for the implementation of decentralization and for all those attempts to solve the conflict in some way. So I would like to thank you, Hannah and Marina, for this wonderful conversation. And again, congratulations on this wonderful volume, which I said is very, very significant and important, not only in terms of the aspects that are presented, but also in terms of the terminology that you try to clarify with this volume. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation.
Today I spoke with the editors of Decentralization, Regional Diversity and Conflict, the Case of Ukraine, Hanna Schellest and Marina Rabinovich, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel in the New Book Network.